My name is Dayton, and I'm an alcoholic, and I was the overall chairperson in 2003. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics and Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have a list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Jeffrey will read the preamble.
My name is Jeffrey, and I'm an alcoholic, and I was the overall chair in 2012. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me a serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Stephanie will read the steps.
Thank you. I like to know where that's. Hi, Stephanie, alcoholic. Hi, I was the overall chair for 2013. The 12 steps of AA. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our lives, our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, properly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Bob will read the traditions.
My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. I was the overall chair in 2008, the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement from AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is our group's 28th anniversary, for which we have a special format. Peggy, one of our founders, will give a brief history of the group, followed by an information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 45 minutes. Please help me welcome Peggy.
My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic, and I was overall chair in 1995, a long time ago. So, many groups start with a resentment and a coffee pot. The Atlantic group did not. It started with a dream and some good examples, the enthusiasm of the Pacific group and its founder, Clancy. And I have been blessed. I've been blessed with having been one of the founders, along with Van, who passed away 8 years ago this month, and the loss to the Atlantic group. Loss of Van to the Atlantic group is incalculable. He was, without a doubt, the Atlantic group's shepherd. The fellowship we chose 20 years ago has grown up around us. Our big book made that promise. It was March, and so now the history of the Atlantic group. It was March 1st, 1994, and we met for the first time at the Convent of the Sacred Heart, 5th Avenue and 91st Street. I had scouted the location and chose it because we would meet in the recital hall, which had red velvet chairs with gold gilt frames and the beautiful recital hall for the private school. Of course, they forgot that the first night that we met, and we had to be stuffed into the library, which really sat comfortably, 40 people comfortably, and we were 75. And those were all friends. These were not people that called into group for a meeting, or obviously we were not in the book. And they all came to support us at that first meeting. In our fifth year, they called me in and they said, you're going to have to lock the door after the 75th person. We were then about 200. And I said, we can't do that. They said, well, why not? I said, well, I'll give you an analogy. If it's the Sloan Kettering, and they're giving chemotherapy, and would someone say the 76th person? And they said, oh, it's not the same thing. And I said, well, actually, we lose more alcoholics than we do cancer victims, which is really the truth. What happened was one of our members, not knowing that Van and I had actually come here to Christ Church, and they told us, no, you can't come on Tuesday night because we have the homeless. And so we said, oh, okay, disappointed. And one of our members, not knowing that, came, and of course he was tall and good-looking, and Rosemary, who's the operations chief, is a young, pretty girl, and I really believe that that's why we got Christ Church. I do. No one's ever said that, but I believe it's so, which is why we now have Dayton go visit with her on any problems that we have. He did go. Frank went and made the arrangement. And we have been ensconced here ever since July 1999, and very happily so. We love this. So I'm going to give you our meeting history. On February 5th, 1996, we started our second meeting, the Big Book Study, and it meets every Wednesday. On July 1st, 1998, our third meeting was our beginners meeting, which meets on Thursdays. On January 7, 2000, our fourth meeting, Steps and Traditions, was launched on the West Side. and meets on Fridays. On October 13, 2002, we started our fifth meeting, which was a call-up meeting, and it meets every Sunday. And on February 28, 2005, began our sixth meeting, 11-step meditation, which meets on Mondays. On February 16, 2008, our seventh meeting, which is a speaker meeting and meets every Saturday. So we've moved around a lot. You know, usually when I would get up here, now, Van always gave the history, and in 2006 he got too sick and asked me to do that. And he actually gave me, and, you know, I looked at them yesterday, some handwritten notes that he wanted me to add. And I have added them. But here is first what he read on our 10th anniversary. And I must tell you, it's as relevant today as it was 10 years ago. What has grown here is loyalty and responsibility to the home group and a sponsorship ethic which stresses Alcoholics Anonymous program of recovery, a desire to do service and to support our service branches with time and money. We have maintained the structure that we developed here, and as a direct result, we have flourished. But this now is Van's note. But I will tell you why we're 10 years old, is what he said 10 years ago. Enough of you are willing to give up for the time you spend at an Atlantic Group meeting, your personal desires, even your demands. Give up your individual, may I say, rights. That for at least while you attend an Atlantic Group meeting, you follow consciously or not the first tradition. The group comes first, and the individual second, albeit a close second. That you are obedient to avoiding the use of street language, dressing according to our dress code, and following another tradition, our primary purpose, carrying the message of AA. It is you, the individual member, being loving and tolerant of your group that makes it work. It is because you made that sacrifice that we are here tonight and we are celebrating 20 years. And if you keep that up, if you remain true to the group conscience, retain the structure, follow the traditions, especially AA's singleness of purpose, you will meet 20, 30, and maybe more years and fill this room with AA music, laughter, and the sharing of love for one another, our fellowship, and especially our group. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Ava, I'm an alcoholic, and I was overall chairperson in 1999. My friend and sponsee, Becca, was our overall chair in 2000. She wrote this blurb for us about Atlanta Group attire. In the early days, showing up in dress attire was a sign of respect when meeting others in public. Many of us have experienced that inability of being able to suit up and show up for life. Dressing in AG attire for commitments such as speaking allows us the ability to show others that we respect our hosts and our responsibility of representing AA and our home group, the Atlanta Group. One way we represent our recovery is by how we suit up and show up for the world. And if that was not enough, because we've discussed this topic endlessly, we wrote an addendum. As everyone wants to know, what does that mean exactly? Representing AA and our home group means wherever we do service, AG commitment or not, we wear AG attire. And then we added, exactly, as AG home group members, we follow all of AG's customs wherever we go in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Thanks.
My name is Bonnie, and I am an alcoholic. And I was the overall chair in 2002. Our seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The baskets will now be passed. Your contribution covers the expenses of our group and also that of our New York Intergroup Office, AA General Service Office, and AA Area Committees. Thank you for your ever-increasing contributions. God bless you. For sponsorship, please see Abe and Sarah. We would like to extend a special welcome to all newcomers and help you find a sponsor and answer any questions you may have about sponsorship. We have a book listing available sponsors. If you need a sponsor, we have names and numbers for you. A sponsor is someone who has paved the path for you, and we encourage you to take advantage of that. We also encourage Atlantic Group members to sign up to be sponsors and all newcomers to attend our beginners meeting, which is on Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Cathedral of the Holy Trinity, 337 East 74th Street, between 1st and 2nd. I would like now to introduce Vince.
Hi, my name is Vince V, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, and I was overall chair in 2006. There are many AA conventions and activities which we take part in. For flyers and more information, see our festivities persons, Brittany and Charlie. Well, at the literature table after the meeting. We celebrate AA birthdays on the last Tuesday of the month. If you are a member and wish to share with us, please confirm with the anniversary chairs, Brent and Mary, after the meeting. If you would like to become a member of the Atlantic Group, please see our membership person, Clinton, and the membership team at the literature table after the meeting. Anniversary Watch. In an effort to promote unity and enhance sobriety, we here at the Atlantic Group sponsor an anniversary watch. This is an opportunity for Atlantic Group members on their 365th day to sit with their sponsor, Atlantic Group members and friends, beginning at 9 p.m., to wait and watch their first year of sobriety be ushered in. Anniversary watches take place at Gracie's Diner on 86th Street and 1st Avenue. If you wish to have a watch for your first year, please see Lauren or Zach at the literature table with your sponsor after the meeting. I would like to introduce Amanda.
My name is Amanda, and I'm an alcoholic, and I was your overall chairperson in 2011. All right, please check the literature area for more information in our newsletter. There are books for sale, and pamphlets are free. CDs of tonight's meetings can be purchased from Terry and Elizabeth at the audio table at next week's meeting. As was said, this meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see remain here. If you are speaking at another group and wish some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. And our main speaker tonight is Clancy.
She swore she was 18. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have run for general secretary of this group 15 times, but I never was here for the election, so I never quite made it. Speaking to Mick. Anyway, I'm very glad to be here tonight, glad to be here for this prestigious 20th anniversary of your group. My home group just had a big anniversary. We speak into mic. Christ, what more can I do? Why don't you turn it up? Try turning up the mic. Maybe that'll work. My home, the Pacific Group, we just had our 50th anniversary. That was not... Now, there's a lot of groups around the country 50 years old or more. But there's not very many with the founder still sitting in the front row grumbling over how things are going. And, Well, I'm glad to see it's an active group. I've been coming here for many, many years. I guess I've spoken on all your anniversaries now for 20 years or so. It's always a pleasure. When I came, I had the privilege of sponsoring Van, who was one of the founders of this group. And when he passed away, it left a big hole. But as in AA all over, the holes fill up and you continue. And I'm very glad to see a number of my friends here tonight. A lot of people have said hello. I've had to do something a little odd. People extend their hands and I stick out my left hand and take it. And they think I'm being eccentric. But I have a broken finger on this hand and a very badly sprained finger. And several people said, well, what happened? And I'm going to tell you. I'm going to give you two versions and you can take your choice. One version is I got up early, as I do every morning, go out to the front porch, get the paper, bring it in, and I tripped over my dog. It was dark, and the fool was laying right there, didn't see him, and down I went. And I got up, and I saw my finger was going that way, and I thought, that can't be right. That's one version. It's very touching. Then another version, a couple months ago, I was at the City Hall of Los Angeles, which is a big tower, and I was up on the 10th floor talking to some of the administrators, and I was taking the elevator down. I was the only one in the elevator, and went down about three floors, and it stopped, and a woman got on who had the largest bosom I've ever seen. I tried not to look. And we went a couple more floors, and she said, would you mind pressing one? And I said, no, I'll give it a shot. And but I'm, well, take your choice. I'm glad to see the half measures balconies filled up at last. Good. We're giving away money down here. But you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a strange and peculiar and wonderful place, but it's very hard to get into. I slipped in and out for 10 years before I stayed sober. I just could not accept the fact that I was an alcoholic or that the therapy they had would help me. I had a great deal of difficulty with it. I always felt in AA, and I'm sure like some of the people here do, I had the feeling that my problem isn't really alcohol. It's all these damn feelings I have and emotions. And I guess I'm too thin-skinned because I feel things too intensely. And I don't seem to mix well with people. I can see an insult miles away where no one else can see it. And it makes me feel inept and less than, sort of. And I try to... Everybody in now? I brought my rabbi to get you if you don't shape up. But I tried a lot of things to overcome it. But it's a funny thing. I discovered finally that alcohol would do it. And that's an odd thing because you hear all the time in AA about, boy, I held that first drink down and I knew I had a new life. Not me. I had just the opposite experience. When I was 15 in 1942, a long time ago, most of you young folks weren't born. And I want to interrupt myself just for a moment to say, you young folks here tonight, in my home group, we have a lot of young people. And if you're like the young people in our group, I want to tell you something. You are the future leaders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you something else. If you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Anyway, but anyway. When I was 15 years old, the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor, and I felt a terrible surge. I grew up in a little town in northern Wisconsin, not much going on, and I had a surge to go kill Japanese and undo the work that they did at Pearl Harbor. And my mother got her to fill my little suitcase, and I said I was going to visit my aunt in Duluth, and instead I got a guy to give me a ride to Minneapolis, and I decided to hitchhike to San Francisco. I'd never hitchhiked before, but I asked some guy how to do it. He said, just stick out your hand and smile. And I was... But finally a guy stopped. He gave me a ride all the way to San Francisco. And I told him I wanted to be in the Marine Corps because I thought those dress blues really looked slick. And I was about this tall and had a face full of pimples and dumb. And he said, you can't get the Marine Corps. You're 15. You may get the Merchant Marine because they're crying for people. All the good guys have gone in the Navy. I'll drop you off the Coast Guard office. Tell me you want to be in the Merchant Marine. Tell me you're 16. So I did that. The guy gave me that. You're out of here. Here, fill out this application. So I filled it out and put down 16. He said, all right, you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And that afternoon, I was on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. They move fast, no training, no nothing. I was on a ship. I was in a cabin with three of the worst type of people that any small, dumb Norwegian Lutheran little puke can be with. These people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I could see there's a little tension in the air, so I told him a joke that I used to go very good in study hall. Didn't go very good there. Get in your bunk and shut up. And these guys were tough. They drank whiskey every day. They all had whiskey in their sea bags. They shouldn't have had, but who's going to stop them? Any other era, they'd be pirates, you know. Ha, 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 ha. And they talked dirty. And I just never heard such things. And I suddenly realized, of course, they've all got black hair. These must be the Catholics I've heard about. That's why they teach us in the Lutheran Church. But anyway, they all drank whiskey, and one day one guy came over to my bunk and said, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort? And he shoved that bottle in my face, and I thought, I better stop this right now. I was going to tell him, you get that bottle out of my face. I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran, and we don't drink whiskey, and we don't even associate with people who drink whiskey, and I'll thank you never to put that in my face again. Don't do it. Leave me alone. I was going to tell him that, but then he said, you think you're man enough? And I heard the voice say, goddamn right. So I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle ever, and I threw it up, and it tasted terrible. The next day they took me into Honolulu, got me a bottle of beer, hated that, and I hated drinking. I'm never going to be a drinker. And we sailed around. We sailed up the Aleutian Islands, got the Japanese out of the Aleutian Islands, and did a lot of things. And when I was 17, I went in the Navy in 1944. At the end of the Navy, at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital outside of San Francisco being sewed together, and the Red Cross had a bunch of extra tests they passed out. And I've always been good on tests because I read a lot. And I remember the guy coming in and saying, gee, Clancy, seems strange, but you're in the top 5% of intelligence in the entire United States Navy. And I said, I know. But they gave me a certificate. I didn't seem like much at the time, but just stop and think. Here I was, getting out of the war now, and I left high school at the end of my sophomore year. I have to go back to high school to be a junior in high school. I'm not going to do that, ever. But fortunately, the VA... A guy in the VA who worked it so I could go to college, that certificate would be enough to cover the last 2 years of high school. And I went to college. And I don't suppose there's anybody here in the room who remembers 1946, but millions of guys got out of the service all at once, and a lot of them went to college because you got the GI Bill. They'd pay your tuition, send you money, they'd pay all your expenses. And it was really great. It was really hard to describe. You'd sit in a freshman English class, and there'd be some grizzled old ex-Marine sergeant sitting there. And some little honey just out of high school next to him. Were you in the war? Yeah. Do you put out? Very rude, but a lot of them did. And but the one thing, of course, the veterans all ran together and did things at night, and I didn't want to be with these goofs out of high school, so I ran around with them, and I forced myself to drink little by little, and after a while, about halfway through my freshman year, I guess I crossed the invisible line, as they say. It began to really make me feel good. And I began to learn for the first time that alcohol got rid of those feelings that were so difficult. It made my skin thicker. I didn't bother about people. It made me feel adequate and strong. And I did quite well in college because I was controlling it. Let me start over. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to miss a single nuance. But it made me feel like something. And I used it because I was able to control it with no big deal. But when I drank, I felt like something. And I became editor of the college paper, University of Wisconsin. I was chief justice of the student court. And I really was doing well. And at the end of my 4 years, I spoke on behalf of the senior class at commencement. And only one thing was wrong. I got a blank diploma. Because in the last semester, I had missed going to an English history class that met at 8 o'clock in the morning, which was much too early for me to go to class. So I had to go to summer school. I was hired to teach journalism at Duluth Denfeld High School. And I was hired to, at the following fall, of course. And I went to go to, I got a job at the U.S. Rubber Company balancing white sidewall tires, and I had to go to this class for 3 hours a week. And I really was resented it because I'd really done some good work at that university. I won a lot of trophies for them. I was quite well known nationally, intercollegiately. And all of a sudden, here I am having to balance white sidewall tires while those idiots all had fun somewhere. And I used to stop in a bar and drink till closing time every night. And that whoever would listen, I'd tell them my story. After a while, they didn't want to hear it anymore, of course. But one night, there was a woman in there that I didn't know. She tried to be a part of a traveling sales magazine team or something. And she listened to my story, and I gave her this whole full blast. And she said, "That seems odd. Look at you. You have kind of dirty clothes. You have kind of dirty fingernails." I said, "I just came from work." She said, "But you don't look like a guy that would win a lot of trophies for a university. I'll show you." And we shot down to the campus. And, of course, it was locked at 1 o'clock in the morning, so I found a rock and broke a pane in the door. And we got in, and we went to the trophy case, and she was overcome. It's hard for me to remember exactly. It was a long time ago, but it seemed to me she slumped to the floor. And I thought she had a flat tire, and I was trying to pump her up there. And a policeman came in and illuminated the scene. I'll tell you, you want to see a passion quencher, that's the number one. You know, "What are you doing there?" "Nothing anymore." And they arrested us, took me downtown, booked me for breaking and entering in the nighttime, 5-year felony in the Wisconsin State Penitentiary. Thank God somebody put in some clout overnight from the university and got down to breaking and entering, or drunk and disorderly. But I remember sitting in court in the morning waiting for the judge to come in. And I was so sick, and oh God, I was sick. And I felt so bad and embarrassed and humiliated. The judge was a friend of our family. And I thought, what could be worse? I found out what. Guy came in with a box and said, "Who's Immersland?" I said, "I am." He said, "Here." I looked at my box, and all my books and all my notebooks were in there with a note from the dean saying, "I covered for you as long as I could, but I can't cover this one. You're expelled." And then a little while later, a telegram came in. Somebody brought in and notified I didn't get my job at Duluth Denfeld because of moral turpitude. And really, all in all, a bad morning. Then the judge came in, who was a friend of our family, and I felt so embarrassed. "I'm so sorry, Judge. I'm so sorry." He said, "Clancy, I've known you since you were a lad. And I regret you're this sorry."
"And why that, Judge?"
He said, "In my experience, when people are that sorry, they're not only sorry for what they've done, but they're sorry for what they're going to do."
I said, "Oh, no, Judge, I've learned my lesson." Ha, ha, ha.
He was right. And so that ended that career. And I had to start over again. And I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer. They drank heavily. Everybody did around there. And I got married. I found a lovely girl that had black hair and black flashing eyes, unlike all those blonde people in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, some with a little mystery to them.
and she won my heart, and then we got married. And I enjoyed writing sports. That's my favorite job I ever had, I guess. But then my wife began manifesting the behavior pattern of Catholics, which I knew nothing about. And I was astonished. Now just pass along my experience. If there's any little Protestant boys here who are going with a good, pretty Catholic girl, and she has won your heart, I want to tell you some news. You are going to have a much bigger family than you ever thought. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just boom. Try to get a better job. I need more money, so I got a job in a big manufacturing company. And I had a flair for writing. I was a good writer, and I wrote in their advertising department. And I did quite well for them. Drank heavily, had a good time, fun. But one day they called me and said, Clancy, you know, you really write well. Thanks a lot. They said, but we really need you here Mondays, too. And when you come in Tuesday, you smell bad. We can't have that. And fortunately, when I was a senior at college, I had run across something that would help me. So I said to him, I said, you're right, Mr. Carlson. I got drinking heavily overseas at the horror I saw. That always touches people's hearts. And I said, they've got this new thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll go down there and get cured in a couple of weeks, and I'll be back, and we'll be in business. He says, okay. We'll cover your salary while you're done, and that's a good idea. Because nobody knew anything about AA. This was 1947, 1950. Nobody knew anything. Just it was a strange place where drunks went and never came back. So I went to an AA meeting. Eight fat guys sitting around a table. One says, what the hell are you doing here? I thought, that's a funny welcome. But I know why that was now. Because I was 22. I looked much even younger than that, and there wasn't anybody in that state under 40 in AA at that time, just as though some 8-year-old kid came in tonight and said, I think I'm an alcoholic. Oh, do you? I think you have a broken nose. But I learned enough about AA to know what AA was. It's a place where bad drinkers, people who like to drink alcohol, go, and they get in trouble. They admit their problem is alcohol, and that makes them feel better, and then they return to God quickly, and they spend the rest of their natural life tending to one another. Jesus, what a drag. And I didn't much care for it. But what that did for me, I could realize I wasn't going to get any help there. So instead, I got a different job in a different city. And I did that for almost 10 years. I'd work in a place, do a good job, until finally they called me, and the heat would be on. I'd play the AA game and with them and look for another job. And the last time I went down was in Dallas, which was, I had just come out of the state hospital through a series of bad breaks. And then some guy really took a liking to me and gave me a big job in Dallas. And they called me and said, you know, Clancy, last week you almost cost us the Fritos account. That's an $8 million account because of your drinking. And so you're done here. You're fired. Clean out your office. Be out of here by work, end of work today. He says, we've called your wife and notified her that you're becoming home with the severance check, so try to get there. And I'm going to try to make it my business to see you never work in advertising again. I thought, God, this guy's overreacting. So I left. I didn't go right home. Nobody wants to go right home. You know the heat's waiting for you. I think about that. A few months ago, there was my dogs, those fool dogs, started barking in the middle of the night. And I barked and barked. I said, shut up! They kept barking. And so I went up to the living room to see what was happening, and they were barking. There was some guy in front of our house sitting on a little wall that's there. And I thought, what the hell's that? And I opened the door. I said, what are you doing out there? He says, I'm going to a lecture. I said, a lecture? About what? He said, about alcoholism. I said, are you kidding? Where in Venice, California, is there a lecture about alcoholism at 2 o'clock in the morning? He said, at my house. And we all know that feeling, I guess. But I drank up all weekend. I drank, finally got home on Monday or Tuesday. My money was gone. I didn't know what to tell my wife. I was going to tell her, but she wasn't there. She had left. She had taken the children and moved away. left a note, we can't stand any more of this. And so I knew I had to get out of Texas because I was signed out of the hospital to her. And I knew she probably blew the whistle on me and they'd put me back in there. So I knew I'd get out of Texas. And there was a guy who I talked to who had wanted a car delivered in Los Angeles. I called him up and said, I'll deliver it. He said, I thought you worked at Tracy Locke. Nah, they're a bunch of phonies. So he gave me a credit card and some money, and away I went. First day I got to as far as El Paso, 300 miles, pretty good lick. And I used to work in El Paso. I was on the faculty of the university there briefly to live on. I didn't have a degree. And I hid my car in a safe place, went to Juarez, where I like to say I am a living legend. And in Juarez, by midnight, I was drunk and goofy and standing on the bar of the Chinese palace singing my song. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. And my fans all going, cabrón, cabrón, which I think means welcome in Spanish. And the next day I was sick and hungover, and I got as far as Phoenix. I didn't know anybody there, and I hid the car. I really hid it well because I didn't know anybody. And I hid it so well, I have not found it yet. And as the sun went down, I was on the street drunk trying to get somewhere. Some guy came, hey, give me a hand, will you, pal? Help me find my car. He said, don't bother me. I said, come on, for crying out loud, help me find my car. He said, don't bother me. And I grabbed him by the lapels. I said, you really are stink. And he said, you shouldn't have done that, kid. He took out his badge. He said, you're under arrest. Took me down to the Phoenix jail. Says, we'll cool you off tonight, boy. I want to tell you a secret. In a jail that's 135 degrees, you do not cool off. But I got to sleep finally. I woke up in the middle of the night. I was so sick. Oh, God. I went to throw up. I thought it was the toilet. Turned out to be somebody's bed. But he wasn't in it. How would I know? You know. And I lay down next to him. I'm sure people have done this. To me, it's the epitome of what you do when you're vomiting, when you're coming off a drunk and you're vomiting. You find a cool piece of tile. Just put your cheek on the tile of the floor, and if you have to vomit again, you're right there. And this guy came back from wherever he was, and apparently he'd been somewhere, and he found his bed full of vomit, and this drunken fool laying there, and he kicked me, you son of a bitch. I didn't think he meant to, but he kicked my front teeth out, which I thought was kind of a bad break. And I bled like a horse for a while, but then it was all right. I woke up. They let me out at 6:30 the next morning, covered with vomit and blood, and just so sick of that. God, how can this be happening to me? I'm a bright guy. But the one thing I'd learned in the past few years of drinking, and that is this, if you're going to be a slipper a long time, it's good to know this, is that when you really get down and out and nobody wants you around anymore and you run out of people, there's one place you're always welcome. An AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Fred. And I found, I said, where's the AA club? He said, there's some guy in downtown. He said, well, there's nothing around here. There's one out in Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell's that? He said, well, you go up this hill to Hill Street and cut over and walk west. And I walked, turned out to be 7.5 miles in that rain and so sick. And I got to the club and I almost didn't go in because there was a guy in the doorway saying, welcome home, son. Oh, shit. But I went in. I had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. I knew all about AA. There was nothing he could teach me, nothing they could tell me. And it's really an odd thing. And that's, all of our stories are different, but we all wind up in a place like that somewhere where, and then it turned out all right. But you never know that's going on, but it's happening. In chapter 3 of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which if you haven't read yet, it's kind of interesting. Chapter 3 talks about what people like us have in common. What do we have in common? Different sizes, shapes, colors, histories, all sorts of things. But there's one thing people like alcoholics of our type seem to have in common. Somewhere along the line, we have all picked up the voluntarily or involuntarily obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. I just haven't found the formula. And I did that for a lot of years. I kept thinking, there's got to be, dummies can stay sober. There's got to be some way I can do it. There's got to be some way I can drink without getting drunk and getting in all this trouble. And it says that we fight against being an alcoholic. Naturally, we fight against people. I don't want to be an alcoholic. That means you just go on the natch for the rest of your life and hurt. Who wants to do that? And it talks about keep drinking until you get to a point. Colorful little phrase. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I used to think, boy, that's how drunk you got. But that isn't what that means, I don't believe. I believe it means that's how you feel after you get sober again. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And people want some rationalization for your behavior, and you haven't got it. So the universal cry of people like me, and I'm sure like you, leave me alone! Get off my back, for Christ's sake! Leave me alone! And know to myself, somehow I'll have to beat this. And try it in a different town, a different city, a different cell. The funny little paragraph they have in the book, changing from scotch to brandy, or drinking beer only, or drinking wine only, or reading spiritual literature, or taking physical exercise, or taking a trip, not taking a trip. I remember reading that and thinking, I've tried every one of those except one. I've never tried not taking a trip. When the heat is on, I move out. I know that much. Only cowards stay and fight their results. But I had no idea I'd be sober, but I fell into the hands of a man whose strength of will and brain apparently overpowered mine. Maybe I was just down and out, I don't know. But he saved my bacon. And he told me, he pointed out things to me that I absolutely knew were not true. And yet, somehow, I tried them. I remember telling him, you know, Bob, I'm not really an alcoholic. I know you're trying to help me, because I didn't say it quite that clearly. I had no front teeth. You know, Bob, I'm not really an alcoholic. I just got a lot of emotions and feelings and problems. Drinking is the only thing I know that makes me even. I go through life like this, and I try all sorts of things, but a few drinks does that. If I just got to find a way to just have a few drinks, I'm sure most of us, you know, stopped for a couple drinks many times and wonder why we were there at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock. And he said, I understand, kid. But he told me one day, he used to give me a series of his opinions and lectures. And one night he was telling me something, and I could hardly bear it. He gave me a three-hour harangue. Thank God I blotted out some of it before I went insane. But in that harangue, I look back and he saved my life and changed my life and made me a different path. He said, kid, you know the problem is with AA? There's a bunch of people around here who have alcohol problems. I said, Jesus, Bob. I thought that's what it was supposed to be. He said, nah, people with alcohol problems, we don't want them in AA. They come here, they talk wisely, and they don't do anything, and people follow them and they die. I said, Jesus, Bob. What do you think people with alcohol problems should do? He said, I think they should stop drinking and clean up their act. And when they're offered a drink, say no, thank you. I said, that doesn't work. I've been trying that for 10 years. And I used to be a big shot. I'm living in an abandoned car in an A-Club parking lot, for God's sakes. He said, I guess that's because you don't have an alcohol problem. I said, I know that, Bob. He said, I believe that you have what all the rest of us people here today have. Looks like an alcoholic, but isn't. What could that be, Bob? He said, something called alcoholism. I said, oh, for God's sakes, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. And he gave me a lecture on that subject. And the lecture was this, that the difference between alcohol and alcoholism, which confuses most of us along the way, we wonder why, what's the difference? The difference primarily
if you've got an alcohol problem, you drink till you get in trouble, get into problems, and you quit or cut down. No big deal, and that's the end of it. Unfortunately, however, in alcoholism, you drink till you have problems, and drink too much, you have problems, and you quit or you cut down. But only temporarily. You must always drink again. You must always go to the limits again. You will again and again and again. I said, Jesus, Bob, I'm a smart guy. And I sit in these AA meetings over the years, listen to the old pukes talk about how much they drank and how bad it was. Why do they drink all this alcohol that is so bad? He said, alcoholics don't drink alcohol because it's bad. You don't seem to know much about things, kid. And he had a cup of coffee in his hand. And he said, I'll tell you what. You know what an alcoholic is? It's a person who gets an unusual reaction to alcohol. Unusual. I said, yes, I know that, Bob. I've heard him talk about it. It sets up the phenomenon of craving. Then they drink, 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 till they go crazy. I said, nah, that's podium talk. He had a cup of coffee. He said, this was Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink. The result would be it would almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It would be softer, a little more friendly, a little more color. And start to fill up those holes in me. I may have another drink to make sure they get filled. And then I discover I'm rather clever too. And I'm glib and I say funny things. They don't know it, but I know it. And you keep drinking. He said, you know what the phenomenon of craving is? I said, no, I don't know. He had a theory. You know, to this day, no one has ever described the phenomenon of craving. But he had an idea that I thought was absolutely right. He said, when alcohol changes you and it does its job, pretty soon you start to sag a little bit. You instinctively have a drink. Until you sag a little bit and you drink a little bit more and you just keep drinking. All of a sudden you're drunk and then it doesn't make a difference. But he says, the phenomenon of craving is no more than just trying to hold what you got. Not going back to that old black and white world. I'm going to stay here where it's colorful and I'm something. I said, Jesus, Bob, I've done that. He said, I know you have, kid. I'll tell you what. I said, there's a woman in our group, I heard her talk that she got sober and then she got drunk again. Why would she get drunk again if it's so wonderful being sober? He said, that's the part of the other part of the problem, kid. The problem is this, that alcohol does so much for us that pretty soon we get to a point where life is not enough. He said, that's why in the first step I'd ask you, one, admit I'm having a power, lost my power over alcohol. Then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And I must also admit I'm having a problem without alcohol. If either one of those aren't right, I wouldn't be in this room, nor would you. If I could drink successfully, I'd be out tonight having a couple of martinis. If I could stay sober comfortably, I'd be home watching a basketball game. When I can't, I go to meetings and I sit there and my head tells me, what are you doing here, for Christ's sake? You deserve better than this. Until you stay here long enough, pretty soon this becomes your life. I never thought that possible. I said, you know, Bob, all those things you said, I've been fighting that for years, but alcohol is not my problem, really. It is when I'm drunk, but it isn't really my problem because I've gone on the wagon, and once upon a time I stayed in my wagon so long after my son died that I committed suicide. It's being sober that kills me. He said, well, there's a name for people like you, kid. I said, what could that be, Bob? He said, I think you're an alcoholic. I said, how could I be an alcoholic? My problem really isn't alcohol. He said, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol, kid. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. If it's your answer, it will be your problem as long as you live. I said, Jesus, why didn't I think of that? He told me that in early December of 1958, long time ago. And
I still didn't really believe I was an alcoholic, but I'll try doing what he says just for a while, see if it works. And I did. And I began using him as a sponsor. I began to stop trying to fool him and do what he said. And little by little, my life got better. And now, recently, I just celebrated 55 years sober, which is nice, but, you know, that's what happens if you don't die. You stay. I'm not feeling well now that I think about it. No, I'm feeling great. I've outlived a whole bunch of people. I've outlived a lot of the people I sponsor. That makes you feel good. You get to go and do their funeral. I'm here to talk about Jim. He died. But the concept of Alcoholics Anonymous is such that, you know, I sometimes wonder. People say, why do you still go to meetings? I still go to meetings. I go to the Pacific Group. I sit there every week, Wednesday night. I go to other groups Monday night, Saturday night sometimes. Why do you go to meetings? I don't need AA. I'm going to tell you something. I don't need AA. When I go into meetings, to me, it's just extraneous. I haven't heard anything new in a meeting in 30 years. What the hell do I want to go there here? Some whiner. Because of this, I have noticed when I don't go to meetings, I stay exactly the same. But everybody around me slowly goes to hell. What's wrong with these people? For Christ's sake! So I go to meetings just to keep you shaped up. When I go to meetings, you all get better again. But it's a funny thing. Over the years, in my early years of sobriety, I did quite well. I got, after 2 years of sobriety, of little jobs, crappy jobs, living in a one-room apartment with a little pull-out bed and a little hot plate to cook on, which I'll tell you was my favorite place to live for a long time. I thought, God, what a lovely place this is. But when I was 5 years sober, I became director of advertising for a big medical corporation. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I brought in Hollywood, and we created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. And we brought the Beatles from Los Angeles. We were slicker than hell. Hey, baby, what's coming on down? Makes you want to tear your tongue out later, but when I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. Baby. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. But that was okay with me. I cried because I had a little bunch of little girls, and I had a little boy, and my little boy died, and this was another little boy. And I was so happy. But then somebody gave me a book on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I read it carefully. And we never had any more children. A lot of times I had to say to my wife, not tonight, honey, I've got a headache. But they're all grown up and all doing well. They all got out of college somehow. All of my kids are doing, only one of my children has been a disappointment to me. My oldest daughter has become a judge. I so wanted a defense attorney, but no. She came home to Christmas a few years ago and she said, Daddy, remember we were little girls and you try to go on the wagon, you'd get so upset and you'd send us to our room? I said, sure, honey, but you remember why. She said, I know, but when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I haven't been near New Mexico since then, I'll tell you that. But it took me a while, but over the years, I guess little by little, I'm not totally stupid, discovered what AA is for. I bet you not very many people have a formula. What is AA for, really? What, to stay dry and drier and drier? At 55 years, I should burst into flame up here. people, am I dry. The purpose of AA, if you're new, listen to this, and I believe this with every fiber of my being. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is fellowship, it's meetings, it's sponsors. All of these things combine to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. They change my perception of reality. They make life a place that I enjoy being with some degree of comfort, with some degree of self-worth, with some degree of ability to help others. The only problem with that is that if it makes you feel good, and when you're not used to feeling good, it takes you by surprise sometimes. And when I was 15 years sober, I was really feeling quite well. Everybody's going good. I live in a big house out by the ocean. I'll be there tomorrow night, sleeping. And in some strange phenomenon happened in my head. I found myself, I resigned my job in Beverly Hills, where I was making some big dough. And for the last 40 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why did you give up your career to run that damn mission? And there's no good answer to that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. So tomorrow morning, I have to get up at 4:30, catch a plane at 6:30, be in Los Angeles at 9:45, and be at that mission at 11:30 for a meeting. And all day long, I'll be surrounded by people dying from alcoholism and drug addiction. And usually in the morning, I go early and walk around the building and see who survived over the weekend. And it's not because I'm a wonderful man at all, but I found a niche that I can do where I can use the abilities I've been given by Alcoholics Anonymous. Two things I want to say before I sit down. One thing, this man keeps waving things saying, stop. You stop. No, he hasn't. I just made that up to hurt him. Come to realize that AA is quite simple. Again and again and again today, we have all sorts of conferences and weekends talking about what the steps really mean, what the book really means, what Bill Wilson really meant. When you stay sober long enough, you realize they mean what they say. That's what they mean. I have a little something here I ran across some time ago from Dr. Bob. Very nice thing. It says, as finally expressed and offered, the 12 steps are simple in language, plain in meaning. They are workable by any person having a sincere desire to obtain and keep sobriety. The results are the proof. Their simplicity and workability are such that no special interpretations and certainly no reservations have ever been necessary. And it becomes increasingly clear that the degree of harmonious living which we achieve is in direct ratio to our earnest attempt to follow them literally under divine guidance to the best of our ability. And that's so true. Just remember that if you can. And I have something else I'm going to read to you for the 20th birthday of this meeting. This was written in Australia, and the guy sent it to me. It made me almost cry. And the name of it is Drunks. If I can find page one, I'll be in business. Drunks. Nope. Get out your sign, kid. Here it is. Drunks by Jack McCarthy. Good name. We died of pneumonia in furnished rooms where they found us 3 days later when somebody complained about the smell. We died against bridge abutments and nobody knew if it was suicide, and we probably didn't know either except in the sense it was always kind of a suicide. We died in hospitals, our stomachs huge, distended, and there was nothing they could do. We died in cells, never knowing whether we were guilty or not. We went to priests, and they gave us pledges. They told us to pray. They told us to go and sin no more, but especially to go. We tried, and we died. We died of overdoses. We died in bed. We died in straitjackets,
in the DT seeing God knows what creeping, skittering, slithering, shuffling things. And you know what the worst thing was? The worst thing was that nobody ever believed how hard we tried. We went to doctors and they gave us stuff to take that would make us sick when we drank. Or on the principle, it's so crazy it might work. I guess maybe they just shook our heads and sent us to places like Rocky Ryan's rehab. We tried and we died and nobody cried. And when we got out of the rehab, we were hooked on pills. Or maybe we lied to the doctors and they told us not to drink so much. Just drink like me. And we tried and they died. We died. We drowned in our own vomit or choked on it. And broken jaws wired shut. We died playing Russian roulette. And people found out what it was. They thought we'd lost. But we knew we had won. We died under the horses, of the wheels of vehicles, under the knives and boot heels of our brother drunks. We died in shame. And you know what was even worse? Was that we couldn't even believe it ourselves that we had tried. We figured we just thought we tried and we died believing we hadn't tried, believing that we didn't really know how to try. When we were desperate enough or hopeful or deluded or embattled enough to go for help, we went to people with letters after their names and prayed that they might have read the right books and had the right words in them, never suspecting the terrifying truth that the right words, as simple as they were, had not been written yet. We died with a shotgun in our mouth or jumping off a bridge. Then everyone knew it was suicide. We died under the Harbor Expressway with our hands tied behind us and a bullet in the back of our head, because this time the people that we disappointed were the wrong people. We died in convulsions or of insult to the brain, as they called it. We died incontinent and in disgrace abandoned. If we were women, we died degraded, because women have so much more to live up to. We tried and we died and nobody cried. And the very worst thing was that for every one of us that died, there were another 100 of us or another 1,000 who wish we could die. We went to sleep praying we would not have to wake up, because what we were enduring was intolerable and we knew in our hearts that it wasn't ever going to change. One day in a hospital room in New York City, one of us had what the books called a transforming spiritual experience. And he said to himself, "I've got it." But he didn't. He only got part of it. "And I have to share it." And he almost had it. And he kept trying to give it away, but we couldn't hear it in New York and Brooklyn. We tried and we died. We died of one last cigarette, the comfort of it glowing in the dark. We passed out and the bed caught fire. They said we suffocated before our body burned. They said we never felt a thing, that it was the best way that maybe we died, except sometimes we took our family with us. And the man in New York was so sure he had it, he tried to love us into sobriety. But that didn't work. Love confuses drunks. He tried and we still died. One after another, we got his hopes up and broke his heart, because that's what we do. And the worst thing was that every time we thought we knew what was the worst thing, something happened that was worse. Until the day came in a hotel lobby, and it wasn't in Rome or Jerusalem or Mecca or even Dublin or South Boston. It was in Akron, Ohio, for Christ's sake. A day came when the man said, "I have to find a drunk because I need him as much as he needs me." Then he had it. And the transmission line, after all those years, was open. The transmission line was open. Now we don't go to priests, we don't go to doctors, and people with letters after their names. We come to people who have been there. We come to each other. And we try, and we don't have to die. Thank you.